Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility presents the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, going in depth with the most interesting innovators, change makers, business leaders, politicians, and activists in Vermont and around the country. This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is made possible in part by People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do. A better business relationship. Fairpoint Communications, small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. Lake Champlain Transportation, a community leader pioneering new paths in business. And by National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years working for a better tomorrow and over 1,000 VBSR members. Here is noted Vermont author David Goodman.
Welcome to this week's Vermont Conversation. The state of education in Vermont is the subject of this week's conversation with Vermont's Secretary of Education, Armando Villaseca. Secretary Villaseca was born in Cuba. He graduated from the University of Vermont and Lesley College, and he has worn just about every hat one could wear in education in Vermont. He's been a classroom teacher, a teacher at the Georgia Middle School, a principal at Reading Elementary, Westford Elementary and Middle School, and Essex High School, and superintendent of the Colchester School District and the Franklin West Supervisory Union. Villaseca is the state's chief education official now, overseeing responsibility for Vermont's public schools, but his title has changed. In 2009, he was appointed Vermont's Commissioner of Education by the State Board of Ed, and now Villaseca is, in fact, Vermont's last education commissioner and its first Secretary of Education, appointed by Governor Peter Shumlin in January. We'll talk about this transformation in a moment. Welcome to the Vermont Conversation, Armando Villaseca.
Thank you, David.
So before we launch into the current events, I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about your personal background, starting with what brought your family here from Cuba.
My family left Cuba in 1963 after the Castro regime overthrew the fairly corrupt and very corrupt Batista government. And our family, like many families, saw this as a good thing. Unfortunately, Castro very quickly started aligning himself with the USSR. So it was when the government started to nationalize property and nationalize businesses that my family decided to leave Cuba and came to Miami in 1963 for about a year and a half, and then moved to a very immigrant-heavy area right outside of New York City for my Yankee fanship in a place called West New York, New Jersey, and Union City, where I was raised and went to school from probably the fifth grade through high school, and then ended up coming to Vermont when UVM many years ago had scholarships for minorities, need-based financial aid for minority students. So I came up and decided to stay and become a teacher and married a Vermonter, and now have been in Vermont for the last 30 some odd years. And as you said, from little tiny Reading Village School, where I was a teaching principal of a school of about 36 kids, to being the principal of Essex High School, that at the time was over 1,600. So I've had a nice career here in Vermont and have seen some wonderful, wonderful schools and strong teachers and good programs. At the same time, we always look at how can we improve and improve what we're doing for our kids? And that's where I believe the governor has really put himself out there and saying we need to do some things differently, particularly around our secondary education students, having more focus on interests in what they want to do in the future, dual enrollment courses, real life internships where students are having an application to what they're interested in learning, so they can decide before I go into some sort of post-secondary education, whether it is, do I really want to be a radio host, for example, because they've had a chance to try it out and see if it's something that they like.
Right. And what originally made you want to go into education?
Well, interesting, and this is, I think, is a great example of what the governor is talking about when he talks about students have flexible pathways. Right now, in most high schools in the country, there are very few options for students to take outside of the sort of normal patterns. You know, they all have to take English, math, science, social studies, foreign language of some sort. What we're saying is, yes, you need to do that, but can there also be a component of a student's interest in what they want to do in the future? The idea of internships was how I became involved in education. When I was a high school senior, they had an opportunity for, during my study hall, if you could go and work in a school. So I figured, not really knowing that I wanted to be in education, but it was something I wanted to try, probably also to get out of school, let's be honest. I'm 17 years old, like many kids, and did a semester-long internship with an elementary school down the street from my high school. After about the second day, I loved being around kids, and I thought this was a great, you know, sort of career pathway. Whether I become a teacher or not, I knew I wanted to do something with people. Well, that led me to UVM and went into education because of that experience I had in high school, and then it was the right choice. Would I have gone into education if I had not had that internship? I'm not quite sure. So what the governor and we're all trying to do is exactly the experience that I had. Try something out when you're 16, 17 years old to see if you like something in that area. If you don't like it, then great. You learned early on that you don't want to be around kids, let's say. I found that it was a very helpful way for me to have a clearer pathway to what I want to do in the future.
And actually, several weeks ago, we had as the subject of one of our shows an internship program that UVM has in one of its classes, and we had on the teacher, Gary Flumenhoft, and as well as a business that takes many interns from his class. It's a solar, kind of a renewable energy company, one of the young students. And so we sort of traced this whole arc, and some extraordinarily high number of students from this one class in UVM that's very internship heavy gets placed with the companies who actually have them as interns. And the business owner, who was our guest, talked about, you know, for him, it's a no-lose proposition. He gets to actually try these kids
yeah.
and see which ones are a good fit. And for him, quite a few of them have been.
Right. I think the challenge that we're, and I think this is a real challenge for particularly the business community, is how do they interact with the schools? How is it you take a college student, might be a little different than a high school student, the oversight, the supervision, if the grades are included. So there is, I think, some things that we need to be able to support businesses in order for them to open up their doors to be able to take in literally thousands of students a year across the state.
So how do you keep from turning high schools where students are getting necessary liberal arts education into vocational feeder programs for these businesses?
One of the things that I say all the time, and I don't want to sound glib, but our job in education is not to produce worker bees. You know, our job is to produce a well-rounded student who has a solid background in the arts, in English, in writing, in mathematics, in civics, which I believe is an area that we really need to improve on in schools. But at the same time, couldn't schools also provide students with what we're calling personal learning plans, PLPs? The governor's talked about it. I just wrote an op-ed piece about that recently. And what a PLP is really, David, you and I, let's say that, you know, I'm a guidance counselor or a teacher, you're a student, your parents and I, we sit down and we say, David, what are you interested in doing as a 7th, 8th, or 9th grader? What are you interested in doing right now? Not what you want to do in the future. You might say, well, I like sports, okay? I like media. I like being involved with communications of some sort. And then from that, they might say, okay, with your interest, you could be a sportscaster, you could be a radio work in a radio station, you could work behind the scenes. There are many things you could do. And if you want to be a radio personality, let's say, here's some of the things you're going to need to do and the type of courses and what you're going to need. And here's the education you may need in the future. And with that, then say, well, David, let's try, see if we can find you an internship at WDEV and to try it out to see if it's something you like. Doesn't mean that you're going to do this, but at least it provides you with a connection with what you're learning at school and what you may want to do in the future, but not, again, putting out a worker per se. Now, career and technical centers have a little bit different focus because they really are much more career-oriented, where you have students at career technical centers who may be taking a year or two in a very focused area, and let's use a simple one, cosmetology. A young woman or young man may be interested in cutting hair, so they go through a program that really focuses on that, and they embed their math and English and other classes into that program. Writing. You can write, whether you're writing about a report for an English class or writing a report on job skills for a particular career. So what we're really looking at is, how do you make high schools more relevant for what kids will be doing in the future? And taking a math class, for example, Algebra 1, the reason you take Algebra 1 is not so you can get into geometry the next year. The reason you should be taking Algebra 1 is because it provides you with some needed background in that you will need in other areas. Part of it is for SATs and ACT college entrance requirements, but it also could be an area that you have an interest in. 2 weeks ago, I was at a fair at UVM, which robotics, and I should have the name. It's First Tech, I believe the title was, where you had these kids who were very interested in math, science, but they weren't necessarily applying those skills. So what this organization does is provide those kids with an opportunity to work together to not only do something, the theoretical piece on paper, but then how do you do it? How do you apply that theoretical knowledge in a really applied way? So it can be for the really, really top math and science students, all the way to kids who may be interested in auto mechanics, welding, being in teachers, whatever. So they really are looking at a much broader base education without ever forgetting that we really have to make sure that our kids are well-rounded and not forget the arts and the extracurricular activities and the commitment to a community service project that helps kids give back for all of the benefits they've received.
My guest today on the Vermont Conversation is Secretary of Education for Vermont, Armando Villaseca. You can join this conversation by calling 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. Let's back up to the governor's inaugural speech this year, which was unusual in that it focused on a single major subject, education. When I was interviewing former Governor Cunin here, she mentioned that she also did a very unusual thing back in 1985 for her first inaugural address to focus on a single topic, education. So I don't know if it's happened in the 25 or so years since then, but outline, if you could, what are some of the key initiatives and why did the governor feel it necessary to dedicate that kind of time to one subject?
I'm going to answer your second question first and then go back to the key initiatives. David, as you know, this year, starting July 1, the governor took over the Department of Education, or now the Agency of Education, that before was not under his or her authority. Prior to this year, there was a State Board of Education that operated independently of the governor's office. Even though we worked closely with Governor Shumlin and prior to that with Governor Douglas, it really was, they didn't have the oversight.
Now, just to stop there for a moment, for those of us outside of the world of education, what is this all about? And, you know, how has your job changed other than you went from being commissioner and are now a secretary?
Well, one of the areas that changed was prior to this year, the State Board of Education appointed, if you will, the commissioner. Had to be approved by the governor, but they were the ones who did all the interviewing and made the recommendations. This past year, the governor was the one who appointed the new secretary. So I applied with a couple of other individuals from Vermont, and fortunately for me, and I think for the state, I was chosen as a secretary. So that's one area. So he now has control over who the Secretary of Education will be. He has authority, complete authority, over the Agency of Education, as he does with every other agency. So there is that much closer relationship between the governor's office, much, much closer than I've ever had before with either Governor Shumlin or Governor Douglas, where he really is very engaged in this. So his inaugural address was focused on education because it is now under his responsibility. And the fact that it's not just under his responsibility, but also an area that he's very passionate about and really sees education and a strong educational system as the backbone for future growth in Vermont, economic development, and to raise the status of Vermont nationally, because we do have a major issue right now that we have declining student enrollment, and has been declining for about 15 years, and we just found out recently that our actual population in the state has now started to decline. I think we're one of two states in the country that are not showing a population increase. And our population, nothing against you and I, David, but they're starting to look more like us than maybe younger families. So education, if we want to grow Vermont and make Vermont viable and strong, we need to be able to bring in folks from out of state who see Vermont as a wonderful place to work and live, and to keep kids who graduate from school in Vermont, high schools in Vermont, who may leave Vermont to go to college, to think about coming back and making Vermont their home. So when the governor sees the reality of what the future holds, he realized that education is a major component in both economic development as well as a way of bringing folks either back to Vermont or coming to Vermont for the first time.
Now, as part of his speech in January, he placed a big focus on so-called STEM subjects, science, technology, engineering, and math. Why the focus on those topics?
Right. And I'm going to just add a little piece, and the governor is talking about this now. We're calling it STEAM. It's science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. Because when you look at the reason I buy my car is, yes, it's a good car, and it's safe and solid, but I also like how it looks. That's where the design component comes in. So we have to, and as I was talking before about the robotics competition, designing the robots that are also appealing to the eye is also a component. So not only do they have to have the science, math, and technology, but they also have to design and the art background that would make a product that would be fairly mundane that could work, maybe look more appealing and more pleasing to the eye. So so he's now starting to say STEAM, and I am also using that terminology. But when we look at the majority of jobs in growth in Vermont, and he's been very clear about this as he goes around the state talking to business owners, quite often folks who are doing high-tech manufacturing, it's not like it was when my mom worked in a factory. It was a garment factory, everybody, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of training. Now, students or employees need to have science and math background, usually up to a certain level of math and science that we have, for all of our students, not been providing. We look at not, and I'm not talking about the, you know, Cal Poly or the MIT graduate at that high level electrical engineering. We're talking about many two-year degrees that require strong math and background. At our next school board meeting, Janet Bombardier and a couple of the folks from IBM are coming to talk about the importance of that, because they're having difficulty finding employees who will take over the technician jobs, which are the folks who keep the machines operating, but need at least through Algebra 2, if not calculus and math. So we're not providing enough of those students, not the students who are, you know, who already decide they're going on to four-year institution, but how about many of those students that aren't sure, have an interest in hands-on applied learning, which is what you need if you're going to be fixing machines, but you also need that math and science background. So we're really looking at many students who need at least some form of education beyond high school, 2 years, a certificate program, an apprenticeship that will prepare them for some of these careers that we have available. And reading, of course, is one of the most important things we could teach kids. Math, the attainment of math in elementary school and middle school is also a clear indicator of student success in the future. So some people might say, I never use algebra. And, you know, I may not use algebra myself on a daily basis, but it helped provide me with a way of thinking that led me to other things. So that's where we're really focusing on science, technology, engineering, math, because that's what the future manufacturing, the future of many of our employment opportunities will require.
So Bill Mathis, who's a former school superintendent here, has written in VT Digger an op-ed piece very critical of this approach. He writes that only nationally two or three of the top 30 jobs listed by the Bureau of Labor Statistics could be considered as requiring extensive STEM training. And he goes on to say that in Vermont, except for registered nurses, none of our fastest growing jobs require STEM training. And he continues, And he says, the myopic concentration on higher, harder STEM skills for all students distracts us from the purposes of education and overshadows the true skills for the 21st century. These include things like communications, responsibility, teamwork, evaluating information, listening, negotiating, and creativity. How do you respond to that criticism?
Well, I'm not saying that, you know, Bill and I have some different philosophies on things, and interestingly enough, he's on my school, on the State Board of Education. When he writes these things, he's not writing them, however, I want to be clear, not as a State Board of Education position. He's writing them as an individual person and his own perspectives. That being said, Bill's right. We need kids who are able to communicate, work together, problem solve, all of those things. At the same time, when we look around the state and we see many of our job openings, whether it's Husky Precision in Milton, or we look at places in Bennington that produce some high-tech equipment for the military, when we look at IBM, they're all saying the same thing. We need more and better prepared students who are able to move into our high-tech manufacturing. The numbers that he's, I haven't seen exactly the numbers. Bill sometimes makes these statements, and what I always say is, well, what are the options? What are the statistics? Because when we work with Commissioner Andy Noonan from Labor, Secretary Lawrence Miller from Commerce, we're all saying that they're all hearing the same thing from the employees. We need more students who are better prepared for math and science. Doesn't mean that you're giving up other things. Again, I'm going to go back to the robotics. Those kids are learning how to do cooperation, and actually they call it co-opetition, I think I got it right, which is collaboration and competition together, because kids need to learn to work together. The days of sitting in a cubicle by yourself are over. It's now more about teams working together, but you still need that math and science. And I think if we follow Bill's position, I think we'll be doing a disservice to our kids and our state. Because again, not just staying in Vermont. If they go to other places, where, you know, whether it's in California with Silicon Valley, or you go to the Raleigh-Durham sort of triangle, Charlotte, there are places that are booming because they have a strong science and math and technology background in their employees. We should not be providing less opportunities in other areas, but if a student is interested, they should move in that direction and have opportunities to work there. I don't think Bill also supports the fact that we want to raise our graduation requirements to include at least through geometry or Algebra 2. And when we look, and we talked a little bit, David, about the number of kids continuing their education in Vermont, we have fewer than 50% of our students who graduate from Vermont who are taking through geometry. That, you know, that really is a terrible thing we're doing to them. And it's a shame that we're not preparing our students in a better way, because you need that. If you're going to apply to any college, four-year, two-year, many certificate programs, many apprenticeship programs, you need that minimum level of math. And to say that we don't need that, I think, is not really looking at the future with all the information that we're seeing. And it'll be interesting because, again, Janet and a couple of the folks from IBM will be at our next board meeting next week to talk about some of the needs that they see that we may need to fill.
Okay. We have a caller on the line. Tom is calling from Waterbury. Tom, welcome to the Vermont Conversation. Tom, are you there? Oh, looks like we lost him. You, as you mentioned, have written an op-ed piece, and one of the things you say in there is that high school today is different than it was for most of us. Mm-hmm. What are the key ways that you see that being the case?
High schools today are much more expansive than they were when David, you and I were in high school. Back then, and even not that many years ago, all your learning occurred in the school. You had the opportunities only what your school offered, and you basically were there for 4 years. And there were some, obviously, if you were in the arts, you could focus a little bit on that with music or fine arts or drama. In science and math and other areas, you can focus on that. But for the most part, what we're trying to do is duplicate. What happens at Harwood is happening at Montpelier, is happening at U32, is happening at Mount Mansfield. What we need to look at is breaking down those walls. So a student who comes in as a ninth grader can be taking online classes, dual enrollment classes, and have opportunities for internships.
Okay, and we're going to pick up that theme on the other side of the news here at the bottom of the hour.
next time you open up your wallet, take a closer look. Ask yourself, does your money have values? At the Vermont Community Loan Fund, we believe that money can have value and values. At the Vermont Community Loan Fund, we value Vermont. We make loans that put Vermonters back to work, supporting local businesses, farms, and food. Our loans build homes and support organizations that provide essential services like childcare. When you invest with the Vermont Community Loan Fund, you're investing in Vermont. You decide how much to invest, how long to invest, and the interest rate you'll earn. For 25 years, we've helped Vermont families, businesses, foundations, faith-based groups, and other folks like you invest in Vermont for Vermont. That's money with value and values. The Vermont Community Loan Fund, putting your money to work for you and for Vermont. Learn more at investinvermont.org. That's investinvermont.org.
The use of drone strikes. Lawmakers have been asking him whether, in his opinion, the president has the power to authorize lethal force like a drone strike against a U.S. citizen on U.S. soil. Eric Holder has written in the past the president could conceivably have no choice but to authorize the military use of such force in circumstances like a catastrophic attack, for example, 9/11 or Pearl Harbor. But he said to lawmakers today,
the government has no intention to carry out any drone strikes in the United States. It's hard for me to imagine a situation in which that would occur. We have within the United States the ability to use our law enforcement capacity.
He's promising that the administration will share more information with Congress about national security policies, particularly the use of such strikes. I'm Rita Foley.
Son, I'm going to need you to get these 10 Toyotas up to Loudoun by July 14th. The New Hampshire Motor Speedway is giving them away as part of the $250,000 Toyota Wheel and Deal pre-race show.
Ready, pork chop? Loudoun, here we come. Yeehaw!
Can't wait for the heart-pounding, foot-to-the-floor NASCAR racing action to return to New Hampshire's Magic Mile? Then buy your tickets now for the July 14th New Hampshire 300, and you'll be entered for the chance to win one of 10 new Toyotas and other exciting prizes, courtesy of Sylvania, Miller Lite, Coca-Cola, and more. The earlier you buy, the more chances you have to win. It's all part of the $250,000 Toyota Wheel and Deal pre-race show where the fans are the winners. Experience the magic for yourself. The New Hampshire Motor Speedway, your destination for wow. For tickets, call 603-783-4931. That's 603-783-4931. Or visit NHMS.com.
Starting your mammogram at age 40 and having it yearly after that? Not everybody agrees with that recommendation now. Don't let that stop you. What we want people to do is go to their healthcare provider, have a conversation with the provider. When should I start my mammogram? And how often should I have it? I'm Teresa Lever. I'm the patient navigator for cancer care at Central Vermont Medical Center. We're accredited by the American College of Radiology. We do 10,000 or more mammograms a year. We do them in the evenings. We do them on Saturdays. We can do early morning appointments. We care about each and every patient. It's not an assembly line. If you run into a problem, how am I going to pay for this? How am I going to get to my mammogram appointment? I can help you figure those things out. So there will be no obstacles at all. Central Vermont Medical Center has a long-standing relationship with Susan G. Komen for the Cure, a leading breast cancer foundation. We want people to know that the financial piece of it should not stop them from getting their screening.
Central Vermont Medical Center, central to your well-being.
For the latest weather forecast, call the WDEV weather phone, 800-585-1211 or 244-1172. The WDEV weather phone, sponsored by Twin City Subaru on the Berlin Mall Road. Stop in today and let one of the gurus introduce you to Vermont's unofficial state car.
Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is pleased to make the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman available, along with Lake Champlain Transportation, a community leader pioneering new paths in business. People's United Bank, find out what know-how can do, a better business relationship. National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years, working for a better tomorrow. Fairpoint Communications, small business owners make it big with Fairpoint, and the over 1,000 VBSR members.
Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. My guest this week is Secretary of Education Armando Villaseca. And just before the break, we had a call, Tom, from Waterbury, who was missing in action, but it looks like he's back. Tom, are you there?
I'm here, thank you. You know, I have to ask this question. What I'm not hearing is how we cut the cost of education. We're spending about $14,000 per pupil on a child, educating a child right now. And there are other places in the country, and I'll mention Mooresville, North Carolina, where they're outperforming our schools, and they're spending $7,500 a child. And they're doing this by what's called flipping the classroom. They're giving computers to every one of the kids, and what they do is they give a lecture to the kids to take home and study, and when they come into school the next day, they do their homework in the school, and they're able to get one-on-one attention from the teacher and through peer collaboration. Vermont's education is not sustainable at its current level. We need to do something dramatic that can actually cut the cost of education down to about an $8,000 per pupil level.
So okay, well, let's let Secretary Vilaseca answer your question.
I think Tom brings up some good points, and if you look at our cost per student and the increases in our education budgets, they are right now continuing to go up. Our enrollment has dropped for the 15th or 16th year in a row, but our budgets and our costs go up, even though school districts have done an unbelievable job over the last few years keeping statewide increases at under 1.5%, 2%. This year, it's a little different story. Part of this, Tom, is we are going to, many schools are going to the one-on-one laptop, Enosburg Middle School, Fairfax Middle and High School. Many schools are going in this direction. The biggest driver for cost is our geography. We're a small rural state. We have 270 schools spread out all over the state. We have schools, high schools as small as 42, 43, 44. We have elementary schools that are also very small. But even that is, those are local decisions that people need to make about what they do with the future of their schools. We can find ways of finding efficiencies in how we operate without having to do some of the things that you're describing that may be the future but are not here today. Our legislators passed two bills over the past few years. One is the regional educational district model, where current supervisory unions would join into one school district. Schools would still be open. Every community would still have a representative on the board, but there would be a lot more, and I don't want to use this as a bad word, but centralization of services, for example, contracts, transportation, food service, special education, professional development, hiring, all those things could be done at a much larger level, which would save money, because what we're trying to do, again, as I said earlier, duplicate what everybody else is trying to do. That's one area. It's a local decision. This legislators did provide $150,000 incentive, as well as a tax break of 8 cents the first year, 6 cents the second year, 4, 2, and then 0 over the next 5 years to help as an incentive. Obviously, that hasn't been a clear enough incentive, because people continue to support schools, which is good, and support school budgets. But at what point do we say, can we organize our system in a more efficient and effective way for kids? It's not about the adults, and I hear this all the time when I talk to school board members and I talk to others, that it's quite often looking at their own needs. We need to look at the entire state. We have under 82,000 students in the entire state. That is a medium-sized school district in most around this country. But we have one school board member for about every 60 students, which is wonderful, because school board members give up an incredible amount of time, quite often not easy, especially around town meeting time or negotiations time. But the question is, can we have a more efficient system that provides more and better opportunities for kids? And I think that's the challenge. Right now, we're looking at supervisory unions. There are a couple of bills right now looking at maybe having supervisory unions merge around regional tech centers as a way of reducing costs. But ultimately, these are local decisions that have to be made by locals. The problem is that locals don't all understand that the budgets that they vote for locally are paid for by all of us. We're in a statewide property tax system. The reason that our statewide education fund is going up 5 cents is because that's what budgets are being approved at statewide. So the decisions made here in Waterbury are being paid for by people around the state. The decisions made in St. Albans, in Bennington, are being paid by all of us. So we have to look at what's in the best interest of our state, and does a model for school structures and governance that was developed in the late 1800s still meet the needs of the 21st century? And can we expect different results with a model that, you know, it's 8 to 3, September to June? We need to really break out of that. Schools should be open 8 to 8. They should be in the summer. Kids should be taking classes after school. Doesn't mean that teachers are all going to be working 12-hour days, but some people come in at 8, leave at 3. Some come in at 10, leave at 5. Some come in at noon, leave at 7, so that we can provide more and greater opportunities for kids. But we're in a system that nobody wants to make any change. And quite often, it's politically pretty difficult, because I think what our elected officials, our school board members hear from their communities, don't change anything. Not changing anything will continue to drive up our costs. And we all complain, I complain about the whole sequester issue. Why can't our politicians come up with a solution rather than letting this terrible thing happen? What I hear in Vermont is, well, when people are sick of it, they'll start voting budgets down. Well, that's not the right way of doing it. That's not modeling for our kids how adults should deal with difficult issues. And when we cut money from budgets, it's hurting kids. You know, we're cutting middle school, you know, soccer programs, or we're cutting freshman band, or we're cutting an advanced placement class because we don't have the numbers in a school to be able to operate them in an efficient manner. So ultimately, we as Vermonters have to decide what's in the best interest of our state in the future, not just about my little town where I live in Westford, but rather how do we all fit in together to improve opportunities for kids that then makes Vermont a state where people want to move to and raise their families.
And I should say, in the interest of full disclosure, I sit on a school board, the Harwood Union Middle School and High School Board, that I was appointed to in the fall and reelected to yesterday. So I can say firsthand, this has been a very challenging year for school budgets. This is my first time seeing it from the other side of the table. Let's just look around the town meeting results. So most school budgets passed, but some very notable ones failed. Among the failures include Aalborg, Barry City, Colchester, Milton, Williston. The Spalding Union High School passed by just 2 votes. First of all, how does this pass-fail rate for school budgets compare to other years, and what accounts for why this is such a tough year?
Well, we have a long tradition of supporting schools, and last year, the year before that, during some pretty tough economic times, the vast majority of our budgets passed. This year, there are some big names in there, and I'm really disappointed. Colchester, which is a place that I used to work at, which has one of the lower per pupil spending in the county, for some reason the community, and it's a wonderful school system, there seems to be a disconnect there, and I don't know why. But the challenge is we can't hold down costs when we have so many fixed expenses. From my position, we have a declining enrollment. We have, for the first time ever, starting to see a reduction in our certified staff. But this past year, the year we're in right now, there was an increase of over 200 support personnel for schools. That's not going to be fixed just because we say, as you know, and I'm sure that as school board members, you work hours and hours trying to count pennies to keep it as low as possible. But we're in a structure that doesn't allow you or any other school district to really reduce their costs when you need, you know, a principal, assistant principal. You got to pay for cost of the building. You're paying for tech center tuition. You're paying for transportation. Are there ways of making the system more efficient that ultimately is better for kids? Because everything I talk about, it's not about saving money. There may be some money saved, but it's really about providing better opportunities for kids. So when people say, hold the budget line, well, when you have a 3% increase in teacher salary, a 15% increase in health costs, gas prices are going up, fuel oil is going up, insurance is going up, everything is going up. So before you've even sat down to look at your budget's up 5%, 4.5%, and you haven't added a thing. So even when you look at most budgets in the state that may have gone up an average of 5 point something percent, I would say that every one of those has reduced staff, has reduced programs, and their budgets are still up 5.5%. So school board members, God love them, are doing an incredible amount of work on a volunteer basis, but they're trying to operate within a system that is historically inefficient in this 21st century. So I think that's the dilemma that we're in, and I don't see any change. And again, our projections for next year, at least what we're hearing, is it's going to be a similar number of between 3 and 5% increases while our enrollment continues to drop.
Yeah, and I mean, I think one of the things, while in the weeds, it's always very tough to find the savings, I think it's always important to look at the big picture, which is, you know, Vermont, year after year, voted quote-unquote smartest state in the nation, some of the top, you know, test scores and things like that. And, you know, I have two responses to that. One is, you're getting your money's worth here. It costs a lot, but you get a lot. And the other is, when we look at those top in the nation outcomes, where would we rather be? So I think on that note, I know you have to get to another meeting, and we'll let you go. And I want to thank you. It's Secretary of Education Armando Villaseca for talking with us this week on The Vermont Conversation.
Thank you, David.
We are going to turn now to the State House, where Dan Barlow, the policy manager for Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, has been keeping an eye on the comings and goings of legislation. Dan, welcome to The Vermont Conversation.
Thanks, David. So, you know, the lawmakers are not at the State House this week. This is the town meeting break where they go back to their communities and meet with constituents and hear what they how the job they're doing is going. And I got to say, you know, I think everyone in the building appreciates this kind of mid-session break. It comes at the right time. Things are just going to get more difficult and harder from here when they return next week. It's what's called crossover by the end of the week, meaning a bill has to pass one chamber in order to be considered possible to pass the other chamber by the end of the session. So there's going to be a mad rush of bills next week trying to get passed. So it's going to be a pretty busy week when they return to Montpelier next week.
So although it's only the beginning of March, this is really often seen as the midpoint of the legislative session, and it's a good time to kind of look at the report card of where things stand. Tell me about some of the big battles that have been going on at the State House, some of the really hot issues that you've been following.
Sure. You know, it's an interesting year where I think there's proposals floating around there that either please everyone or you're really making everyone kind of aggravated. So you're seeing, you know, the governor fighting a couple of different fights on some issues. You know, his proposal for child care subsidies is pretty controversial with some of the low-income advocates, so he's fighting battles there. There's battles brewing over what to do about the gas tax to raise more money for our roads and bridges. And, you know, right now, despite that last year at town meeting, a lot of Vermonters called for less money in their elections. We see a campaign finance reform bill coming out of a committee that will actually raise the limits that people can give to statewide candidates. So it's really interesting. There's a lot of stuff at play. And I think, you know, by the end of the session, there's going to be no one will be, I think, really thrilled, but maybe some people will hold back some disappointments.
Now, let's talk a minute about a few of the specifics. First of all, the governor's child care subsidy. This was a centerpiece of his inaugural address. What's the fight been around that?
Well, you know, that was part of his inaugural address, one of his big proposals this year. It kind of instantly, you know, landed as a thud for a lot of lawmakers, a lot of low-income advocates, because they see it as taking money away from low-income Vermonters to help other low-income Vermonters. And there's a lot of concern about what the effect that will be. I think everyone agrees that, you know, supporting more child care subsidies for working Vermonters is a good idea. They don't necessarily agree with the proposal of how to fund that.
The GMO bill passed the House Agriculture Committee on Friday and is now headed to the House Judiciary Committee. What have been some of the challenges that bill has faced?
Sure. You know, first of all, I want to thank the House Ag Committee. They did an incredible job working on this bill, took a lot of testimony. I think they really listened to Vermonters who are telling their lawmakers that they want to know what's in their food, that they have a right to know what's in these products. But there are a lot of legal questions surrounding this. You know, I think everyone prefer a federal solution here. We're not holding our breath for Congress to tackle GMO labeling anytime soon, however. So there are some concerns, and we, I think, heard it from Governor Shumlin when he was addressing, I think it was the Rutland Chamber of Commerce yesterday morning, that he's concerned that Vermont could be sued. And quite frankly, the biotech industry has made it clear that they will sue Vermont if we pass this law. So, and on the other side, there's a lot of, I think, lawyers and experts who believe that Vermont can defend this suit if we do pass the law. That said, Vermont has had, in recent years, a lot of very expensive lawsuits it's been fighting. So I think there's kind of a lawsuit fatigue at the State House and for the administration right now.
The wind bill, without a moratorium, is moving forward. Bring us up to date on that.
Sure. You know, this is one of the big bills of the State House this year. It came out of Senate Natural Resources and Energy. You know, remember, this is a committee that was restructured. The chairman was one of the co-sponsors of the wind moratorium bill. That bill was voted out last week in a 4-1 vote, as you said, without the moratorium, which was a bit of a surprise. I think the committee did listen to a lot of concerns from Vermonters and people working in the renewable sector that this would send a wrong message. That said, the bill, as it emerged from committee, it doesn't make everyone happy. I think wind opponents are unsatisfied that it doesn't have a moratorium, and renewable energy supporters are upset because it does place more regulatory hurdles in the path of large renewable energy projects.
In what way are there more hurdles?
Sure. So right now, these projects, the larger projects, go through the Public Service Board, which has to consider local Act 250 in there. But they can overrule some of that stuff by saying this project is in the public good. So this would actually require local Act 250. These projects would adhere to local Act 250 regulations.
And that then involves issues such as noise, view, high elevation development. These are all things, but aren't those already things that have to be addressed?
You know, yeah, again, the Public Service Board does look at these things. They do address it, but they have some leeway to say, you know, the public good of having more in-state renewable energy kind of trumps some of these issues. So this is going to be a big fight going forward. I expect it till probably the bill to land on the Senate floor relatively soon. It's in, I believe, Senate Finance right now. And, you know, there's a strong possibility that now that the moratorium is out, this gives cover for some senators who were nervous about voting for it in the first place. So I think it's going to be a harder fight on the Senate floor now that it doesn't have the moratorium in it.
And now the Senate Natural Resources Committee, the chair, Senator Hartwell, had basically taken over the committee and had sponsored the original moratorium. So what happened to the wind moratorium?
You know, they got a lot of testimony from, you know, BBSR, BPIRG, people who are involved in the renewable energy sector that were really, really concerned that this would send the wrong message. And I could see the headlines on, you know, Fox News, that, you know, that Vermont, this, you know, liberal hippie state, passes a wind moratorium. And that would be a wrong message to send. And also not in line with the state's goals of having quite a bit of renewables in state by 2050. So, you know, and I got to give props to someone like Senator Snelling, who towards the end of the discussions in the committee said, listen, we have to add some findings in this bill that addresses climate change, that talks about global warming, that calls for more renewables in our state. That piece was missing from the findings of the bill.
Was there, you know, Senator Bernie Sanders weighed in on this in a very unusual move to kind of insert himself into a statewide conversation. How was that received in the State House?
You know, I think, no pun intended, I think that's when the winds changed on this issue at the State House. You know, as you point out, it's kind of unusual for a senator or one of our congressmen who are in D.C. to wade into these state issues at the legislature. But I think him coming out was maybe a gut check for a lot of people who were on the fence about this issue. So I think he had quite a big impact on this. So, you know, I think maybe the bill passed out of committee could have had still the moratorium in it if Senator Sanders hadn't spoken out.
It's interesting because in the initial coverage of that, it was mostly of the, again, to use a phrase, blowback against Senator Sanders for getting involved at the state level. But your take is that long term, this actually turned the tide.
I think it did, and I think it's only going to, you know, again, you know, we saw the Castleton poll came out last week. You know, vast majority of Vermonters are in favor of large wind development, even if it would be in their backyard, so to speak. So I don't think there's any fallout for Senator Sanders here. I mean, he's probably one of the most popular politicians Vermont has seen in its entire history.
And finally, marijuana decriminalization has not seen action so far this year. Where does it stand, and what are its prospects?
Sure. You know, I've been kind of, I put my bet money this year on marijuana reform being the sleeper issue at the end of the session that attracts a lot of attention. And I still think that's a solid bet this year. There's a bill in the House. There's a bill in the Senate. Neither of those have moved forward at all. There's been no committee hearings or anything like that. But, you know, with the votes in Colorado and Washington last year, you know, to go towards actual legalization, I think there was a sense that, you know, the time is moving beyond Vermont, and that, you know, moving towards decriminalization is almost the moderate mainstream position now when it comes to marijuana reform. So these bills have been kind of given a reprieve from the crossover regulations. Leadership has said the bill will still be considered, even if it doesn't pass, you know, one chamber before the end of the next week. So I think, you know, if the stars align, this could be a big bill and a big discussion by the end of the session.
And is legalization part of the conversation?
It is part of the conversation. My memory has been, you know, maybe about a month since I've read those bills, that they focus on decriminalizing small amounts of marijuana. I think less than 1 ounce is the amount in the bill, and putting us towards a path of a possibly legalization and regulation and taxation of marijuana. But it doesn't pull that trigger right away. And I think there are some questions that Vermont would need to answer first. You know, the law enforcement community brings up some very good issues. You know, how do you tell if someone's driving under the influence of marijuana? It's a lot easier to tell if they've been drinking alcohol and they're driving intoxicated, but there's no roadside test for driving under the influence of marijuana. So that's one of the issues I think the legislature would have to address before we go towards legalization.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you. This is Dan Barlow, the public policy manager for Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility. That'll do it for this week's Vermont Conversation. Tune in next Wednesday at 1 o'clock. Our guest for the hour will be Green Mountain Power CEO Mary Powell. We'll talk again then. Thanks.
You have been listening to the Vermont Conversation with host David Goodman. Tune in next Wednesday when, once again, Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility and its over 1,000 VBSR members bring you David Goodman with this special program. It's also made possible by Fairpoint Communications. Small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years, working for a better tomorrow. People's United Bank, find out what know-how can do, a better business relationship. And Lake Champlain Transportation, a community leader pioneering new paths in business.